Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind here on ACB Radio, where your listening is our business. I'm Brian McCallan. This show airs every Wednesday at 10:30 p.m. Eastern. I have an announcement to make. Remember when I interviewed Sabria Tenberkin about the Kontari School on a previous episode? Well, the intake process has started for the next Kontari course in May 2015. For more information, go to kontari.org and click admissions. That's K-A-N-T-H-A-R-I. You may also learn about Kontari by going to newindianexpress.com and typing in a Kontari for Changemakers, or go to zodculture.com, that's Z-O-D, and search for Sabria Tenberkin and Paul Cronenberg, Facilitative Humanitarianism. Now on to today's show. ABC News reports that, at the age of 24, Dr. Amy Bauer participated in a routine eye exam. The exam revealed that Bauer's blurry vision was a sign of Stargardt's disease. It's a juvenile form of dry macular degeneration. The diagnosis was changed from Stargardt's disease to retinitis pigmentosa with macular changes a few years later. Dr. Bauer's vision has degraded over the past 20 years. Dr. Bauer's vision loss hasn't stopped her, though, from being an oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. She joins us to talk about her vision loss, her oceanic journey, and her exciting research. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bauer.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be with you.
So what's wet age macular degeneration, and what's your vision because you have the disease?
Yeah, I actually have a dry form of the macular degeneration, but it's associated with retinitis pigmentosa. So it has changed quite a bit over the years. Initially, I really only had central vision loss. So the first symptoms were I was unable to read normal-sized text, recognize faces, what else? See a blackboard clearly, anything that you use fine vision for. And as I understand it, I'm no doctor of medicine, but I believe that it's due to a malfunction of the cells that remove, a malfunction that causes cells not to be able to remove waste product in the retina, the macula specifically. So the this detritus builds up in the cells and eventually chokes the cells off. So that's sort of the macular degeneration piece. But in fact, I also had early on symptoms of night blindness. I didn't really recognize it at first. I thought it was just, I'm a little different than other people. Maybe in my late teens, early 20s, I noticed that. But that was probably an early sign of retinitis pigmentosa. And since then, I've lost almost all of my central vision and a good fraction now of my peripheral vision as well from the RP. So I still have a little bit of useful vision, but I can't really, I can see objects and things around, but I certainly can't read text. I can see text, I can see letter by letter, but I can't really read. So those are some of the results of this vision disorder.
Let's talk more about how you became interested in oceanography. Why did you decide to study oceanography?
As a kid, I grew up on the coast of Massachusetts, north of Boston, and I was always interested in the outdoors, the outdoor environment. In high school, I was interested in physics and math, though I got some good training in that. But I never really was interested in high-energy physics, particle physics, nuclear physics, things like that. I was more interested in the Earth system. And when I was in college, I found out there was a field called physical oceanography, where you study the physics of the oceans, basically. So that way I was able to combine my real interest in the outdoor environment with my training in math and physics.
Your curricula vitae CV shows that you completed a C semester with Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, and you got your Bachelor of Science in Physics at Tufts University in Medford. That's still Massachusetts. And you also got your doctorate, your PhD in oceanography from the University of Rhode Island, Narragansett. That's how it's pronounced, right?
Yeah, Narragansett.
Narragansett. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How did completing your education speak out about your abilities to be an oceanographer?
Well, the C semester program that I did was where I discovered this field of physical oceanography, where I could combine physics and geoscience, the science of the Earth system. So that was really a turning point in my education and in my career selection. Then I went on to graduate school then, knowing that that was the part of geosciences that I was most interested in. And PhD, I've just always been interested in learning new things a lot. So I feel like I'm a lifelong student, and I enjoy research because it involves learning new things that no one else knows about every day. And I really get my kicks out of that.
You've utilized your abilities as an oceanographer to work in several roles with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or WHOI. You've been with the institution since 1988, and you were formerly the associate scientist and also a postdoctoral scholar and an investigator. What were some of the best studies that you conducted while you played these two roles, and how did you advocate your abilities to conduct the studies?
Well, a postdoctoral scholar was my first position at Woods Hole, which we also call HOI, W-H-O-I. And that's sort of like an internship. After your PhD, you start working much more independently, but still under the mentorship of a senior scientist. And then I moved up the ranks, just like in professors have ranks in universities, from assistant professor to associate with tenure, and then usually full professor, or in our case, senior scientist. Whew, I've done a lot of studies. Which ones were, as a postdoc, postdoctoral scholar and investigator, I furthered really the research I had started in my PhD on the Gulf Stream. I was looking at, the Gulf Stream is one of the largest currents in the world, carries a lot of warm water northward, but there wasn't much known about how water mixes across this big current, and that's what I focused on in my PhD, and I continued that research as a postdoc. Later on, I started to branch out from that particular topic into other topics, including several studies on the deep currents in the ocean, and that's most of my focus is on that nowadays.
You mentioned going on these oceanic expeditions, one of them the East Gulf Stream moorings, a voyage to the A2 deep complex area of the Red Sea, and even an Eastern Atlantic float test cruise. Tell us about these exciting adventures.
Well, they're just a few of several. All of those. The Eastern Atlantic float test cruise, that was earlier in my career. I wanted to use a new type of instrument that floats around with deep currents, and we track them underwater using acoustics. But there were several types of these floats being manufactured in the U.S. and Europe. And so I took one type on a cruise with other scientists, and we sort of compared how they performed. That was in the 90s, early 1990s. So that was quite early in my career. On the other end, the Atlantis II deep brine complex in the Red Sea, is very far afield from the Atlantic Ocean. And that was a project that I became involved with a new university in Saudi Arabia. They wanted to start a marine research program, and they partnered with my institution to do some unique studies in the Red Sea, which they are adjacent to and are very interested in. I'm also interested in the Red Sea. It's a very unique marine environment. It's very salty, has some interesting currents. And so it was a great opportunity to go and study that area.
Cool. Some of your current oceanography research interests include overflows and outflows, mesoscale and sub-mesoscale eddies, and western boundary currents. What are these types of oceanic phenomena for our non-sciencey types out there? And what are some of the current studies in these areas that you've, what are some of the current studies that you've mm-hmm. conducted in these areas?
Right. Okay. The overflows and outflows, I'll start with that one because that does pertain to the Red Sea. There are certain basins, ocean basins around the world. The Mediterranean is one, the Red Sea is one, the Greenland Sea, where very dense ocean water is produced, either by cooling the water or evaporating the fresh water, which makes the basin much saltier. And so that water gets very dense, and then that dense water flows out into the greater ocean basins, usually through a little narrow strait or over a little sill. It kind of makes an underwater waterfall. And I'm very interested in these, like we call them marginal seas. They're usually around the edges of the larger ocean basins. And so that's, those marginal seas are where the temperature and salinity of a lot of the ocean waters are set. So they're kind of birthplaces, sort of different types of ocean seawater. Let's see, so that's the overflows and outflows. Eddies is another favorite topic of mine. Eddies are large swirling masses of water, almost like storms in the atmosphere, like cyclones or hurricanes, except they're not nearly as fast as a hurricane winds, you know, which can be 100 miles an hour. There are no ocean currents that are that fast. But we still have the same kind of rotation in the currents. And these eddies are everywhere in the ocean. And they can have little ecosystems inside them and transport those ecosystems and the water inside them for long, long distances from where the eddy is formed, and then dump the contents from the middle of the eddy somewhere else. So that's one reason I'm interested in eddies. So those are two of the kinds of phenomenon that I enjoy studying.
That's great. The next two questions, Dr. Bauer, come from Julian, from the Dialogue in the Dark exhibit in Hong Kong. He asks, 1, can a blind person pilot a submarine? And 2, what can be done to all those trashed tires and plastic garbages in the ocean?
Okay, on the first question, can a blind person pilot a submarine? That's an interesting question. I think it could be possible at some point. There's certain submarines where no vision is used at all to see outside anyway. A military submarine, a Navy submarine, for example. But the pilot does need access to lots of data coming in quickly on screens, usually. I mean, I think usually a vision, someone with normal vision is the pilot. And so in the future, I can imagine that a lot of that kind of digital data will be accessible to blind people. And at that point, I think probably a blind person could, in theory, you know, pilot a submarine. The research submarines that we have at Woods Hole, however, they operate a lot near the seafloor, and they sort of swim along near the seafloor. And in that case, the pilot is looking out the window to look for hazards nearby, you know, mounds of rocks or whatnot, because they don't want to bump into anything. So that would be a little more difficult for a blind person without some sighted assistance. So the second question about the garbage patches, this has been in the news lately. In fact, just I think it was earlier this week, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times about the garbage patches. And it's a very good question what we're going to do about that. There's number one, all the plastic that's already in the ocean environment. What do we do about that? And then how do we stop the influx of plastics into the ocean? Both of those are huge questions. I think the stuff that's in the ocean, it's going to be pretty difficult to clean that up. It's all huge, covers huge areas. It's sad to say. And it's actually the ocean currents that are pushing that plastic all into big patches. There are convergence regions where the currents come together, and so the plastics tend to congregate there. It covers thousands and thousands of square miles. I think that's going to be pretty difficult, but we can start to stop the flow of plastic into the environment, you know, and everyone can contribute to that just starting by using reusable shopping bags, for example.
Let's go back to your expeditions. What are some of the dangers that you face while you're on these journeys, and what sort of concerns do your fellow crew members have in terms of finding your way on the ship and not even falling overboard?
Right. Yeah. Falling overboard is the last thing I want to do. That's for sure. But, you know, there are many, many blind people take cruises on cruise ships, right? So in many ways, it's not that different. It's a platform. It's a building. Basically, a ship is a building with different stories or floors with ladders, but they're not vertical ladders. They're like steep stairways, you know, that go from deck to deck. And there's a cafeteria, and there's your stateroom where you sleep, and there's the laboratory. So getting around on the inside of the ship, it's just that it's rolling a little bit. So that can make it a little bit more challenging. I did just finish an expedition this summer, and it was pretty challenging. The weather was relatively good, but still having my cane in one hand left me only one other hand to hold on. So I couldn't carry anything else, for example. So I stay well away from any edges of the ship that are open, but there are railings all around too. So it would be pretty hard for anybody to fall overboard, actually, unless the weather was very, very rough. And in those cases, they usually stop the research anyway. We're not allowed to go on the deck. So it's sort of like just getting used to navigating an area that's new to you, you know, like a new building or new workspace or something like that.
You've completed a number of other professional activities with HUI. They include being on the Access to the Sea Strategic Planning Committee, co-chairing the Subcommittee on Ships and Ship Operation for Access to the Sea Task Force, and the Ethics Program Committee. What do you do on each committee, briefly?
Sure. Well, the first two had to do with planning for ship operations at Woods Hole. We operate two large vessels and several smaller ones right now. And we work pretty hard to make sure those ships are well outfitted and can do the most cutting edge research that that can be done. And we have committees of scientists that help make that happen. And so those first two were involved with that. The Ethics Program Committee was a committee set up to run an educational program for junior scientists on ethical behavior in scientific research. There are many issues that young people need to know about, and so they don't, by accident, stumble into a problem with, inadvertent plagiarism or things like that. So it's just an educational program.
You've won a couple of awards. One of them is the N. Hobbs Knight Scholarship Press in Physics from Tufts University in 1981 and the Chrysalis Award by the Center for Vision Loss in 2012. How did you speak out to outturn these honors? And tell us about these awards, too.
Yeah, the first one was at my undergraduate university, Tufts University, and it was basically a GPA-based award for seniors graduating with physics majors. The Chrysalis Award is much more recent, and that was awarded to me mainly for my outreach work with the Perkins School for the Blind and other blind and visually impaired students, trying to make sure those students have information about how they too could become a scientist someday.
You're involved in an outreach program called Ocean Insight at HUI. What's the program about, its goals, and the role?
Ocean Insight was begun in about 2007, and it's a collaboration. It started out as a collaboration between myself and Kate Fraser, who's a science teacher at the Perkins School for the Blind. And its goals are severalfold. I'm not sure I can remember them all verbatim, but one of them is just to get students who are blind and visually impaired excited about ocean science and geoscience in general. And to inform them, you know, about what are important issues for society that have to do with the oceans. And also to just demonstrate by my speaking with them and showing them how I do my research, that they have access to these careers. They might not think so, and their parents might not even be aware that these students could be scientists if they wanted to work hard and they were interested in the subject. So I want to show them that, yes, they can be scientists.
You've also written a blog titled Another Step Forward for Accessible Science. Tell us what the blog's about and how we can look at it.
Sure. The blog I just started this summer, the occasion for kicking it off was that I did take part in a research expedition for the entire month of July. It was in the North Atlantic, started in Iceland and it ended in Iceland. So I decided to try my hand at writing a blog that is geared mainly towards blind and visually impaired students, but also the general public. And it's to pass on whatever I'm learning or whatever questions I have or comments or thoughts or musings about being a scientist who is blind and what, you know, special skills or special tricks and tips I might be able to pass on as I learn my way. It's something I wish I had earlier on in my career, sort of a mentor who had been there before, you know, who had figured all these things out for themselves and could pass it on to me. So I'm hoping to pass some of what I've learned on to others through this blog. And the address is http://web.hui.edu/oceaninsight. That last word, Ocean Insight, is all one word. So it's http://web.hoi.edu/oceaninsight.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just to give a plug for geoscience and ocean science in particular. It's a really, really exciting field right now with many implications for climate change. The oceans are a huge part of the climate system, very important. And so oceanography is really coming up in the world these days.
Dr. Bauer, you're an inspiration to us all future oceanographers out there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Before we go, I welcome comments and suggestions on today's episode and past and future shows. Just visit and like me on Facebook at Speaking Out for the Blind or follow me on Twitter at Speak Out Blind. That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening and remember to speak out.
Take a journey with me, Dan Kaiser, in the frivolous world of
a big fun show.
All I know is this violates every canon of respectable broadcast.
The show airs on Saturdays from 10 to 1 a.m. Pacific, 1 to 4 Eastern, and on Fridays on the Grid FM from 5 to 8 p.m.
Oh, brother.